Media at Illinois.
Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today, March 29th, 2009, here on WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Today we have as our guest one of the most prominent internet bloggers and political columnists since the internet's come into existence and really emerging as one of the great political writers of our times. We'll be talking for the full hour with our guest, Glenn Greenwald, from Brazil, of all places. So please sit back, relax, and enjoy this show. But before we go to Glenn Greenwald and talk about the state of politics and journalism today, let's first go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement. The internet was designed as an open system. Everyone with internet access can download and upload legal content of their choice without discrimination or interference. But according to a new report by Free Press, all that is about to change if internet service providers are allowed to use a technology called Deep Packet Inspection. Deep Packet Inspection, or DPI for short, allows internet service providers to probe internet traffic. They say they need DPI to secure their networks and minimize congestion on the net. But DPI can also be used to prioritize certain internet traffic, speed up or slow down applications, or target advertising to consumers based on electronic snooping. These uses violate net neutrality, the long-standing internet principle that keeps the internet open and free from discrimination. Last year, Comcast was caught using DPI to secretly block a file-sharing application called BitTorrent. Comcast claimed it was just managing congestion, but the FCC ruled that Comcast had violated net neutrality and forced the company to stop its practices. Comcast is no longer using DPI. Chris Riley, policy counsel of Free Press, said that Comcast's new practice isn't perfect, but it isn't violating net neutrality. He says ISPs like Cox that are claiming they need to manage congestion using DPI have ulterior motives. What they are really interested in, he says, is monetizing the internet.
They're trying to turn the internet into cable TV so that the certain uses of the internet are sped up, others are slowed down, and so that eventually they can move away from this flat fee per month for all-you-can-eat broadband. And they're disguising this attempt to turn the internet into cable television by pointing to growing congestion problems.
The scenario Riley talks about is bleak. Consumers paying more for access to less content and limited opportunity for new internet businesses to enter an increasingly closed and segmented market. If DPI isn't reined in, Riley predicts a balkanization of the entire internet, where applications and services will run differently on each network, kind of like the way cell phones and their networks operate today.
And so as the consumer, you will find this video site or this email service that you really like, and then you'll go from your home into your office and you'll be on a different internet service provider connection and it won't work the same.
Can the government legally spy on your computer data and communications? And what can you legally do to protect yourself against such intrusions on your privacy? Those are the two questions the Electronic Frontier Foundation set out to answer in their new guide, Surveillance Self-Defense. This is not paranoia. Consider the National Security Agency's warrantless wiretapping program and the FBI's abuse of so-called national security letters to obtain records and other communications information. EFF has been holding training since 2005 in response to requests for education about how exactly people may be at risk for government spying. Kevin Bankston is a senior staff attorney.
In an age where anti-terrorist agents are infiltrating peace meetings of Quakers and other potentially at-risk organizations, those who serve minority populations, those who advance controversial political causes, they need to be informed and know how the law protects them and how they can use technology to protect themselves when the government wants to obtain their information.
Surveillance self-defense focuses on risks to three types of data: those stored on your computer, those being transmitted, and those stored by third parties, such as cable or phone companies. Solutions range from simply deleting unneeded files to encrypting email and using anonymizing tools for data that is stored with third parties. Bankston says even with the new administration in Washington, it's important to be well informed.
The powers that the government has to surveil are still quite broad and indeed have been expanded by new laws such as the USA Patriot Act back in 2001, the Protect America Act in 2007, and the FISA Amendments Act of 2008, such that the government has more legal power to spy on Americans than ever before.
Bankston says that changes to the laws will only come with citizen participation, and education about the laws is the first step towards meaningful participation.
Later this year, there are going to be debates over whether and how to extend portions of the Patriot Act that are expiring. Eventually, there will be reconsideration of this past summer's FISA Amendments Act, which broadly expanded the government's ability to wiretap in national security investigations. And so when those opportunities come, the citizenry needs to be ready. They need to know what these issues are and what's being debated.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Okie dokie. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you today, March 29th, live on WILL AM 580, based in Urbana, Illinois. It's a pleasure to be here. Our guest today is known, I think, to many of our listeners, but maybe not to all. And I think if you're listening to this show and on a regular basis and you're not familiar with Glenn Greenwald, I urge you to become so familiar. Glenn Greenwald is a political writer and columnist for Salon.com. He's the author of three books, How Would a Patriot Act?, A Tragic Legacy, and most recently, Great American Hypocrites. And he's emerged as one of the really outstanding independent journalists of recent times. In fact, just this week, this coming week, Glenn Greenwald will be honored with the inaugural Izzy Award from the Park Center for Independent Media at Ithaca College. And full disclosure, I was one of the judges that awarded Glenn Greenwald, who will share the award with Amy Goodman, with this prize. And one of the great pleasures of my job is being able to read an enormous packet of Glenn Greenwald's writings over the last couple of years. So, Glenn Greenwald, welcome to Media Matters.
It's really great to be here, and thanks for the nice words, and thanks for having me.
Well, you know, I've... Just a little bit about your background, because it's an interesting route to becoming a journalist that you've taken. You didn't begin as a journalist. In fact, talk a little bit about what you did before you were a journalist and how you ended up as a political writer.
Well, I actually went to law school and practiced law for about 10 years after law school, litigating a lot of constitutional cases and some civil rights cases, things along those lines. And about 3 years ago, I was a fairly avid blog reader and had been reading blogs in order to inform myself politically for about a year or so, and really felt like the highest level political discussions were taking place, among other places, on blogs. And in October of 2005, I just kind of spontaneously, without any plan whatsoever, began my own blog, really as an attempt to kind of join that conversation that I had found so exciting and kind of engaging. And I began my blog about 6 weeks before the New York Times revealed that the Bush administration was spying on Americans in violation of the law without warrants. And when the New York Times revealed that, I almost immediately began writing on a daily basis about it. It really kind of was the intersection of a whole variety of interests that I had. And I kind of became a much-cited writer on that topic, and my audience grew very, very rapidly, and everything sort of developed from there. So it was very spontaneous. I didn't have any plan, but it really kind of demonstrates how the internet these days enables you to build a platform, build an audience, and without really having to work within any constraints, be able to reach a very broad audience.
One of the things that's striking about the best blogging, in particular your work, Glenn Greenwald, is that it's really not like just reading an online version of a print article. I mean, because of the links that you embed in your stories, you really are you know, when you read a piece, you can go off to another 10, 20, 30 pieces in the midst of a single piece.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think it's interesting, the question about what distinguishes a blogger from, say, someone else, such as a journalist or a pundit or something. And I think for a long time, the idea was that it was really just the format that distinguished bloggers, namely the fact that bloggers write online as opposed to in some magazine or newspaper. But it's really a lot more substantive than that. As you say, one of the aspects of blogging that isn't true for standard journalism is that you can write without any length constraints. And so you're able to develop arguments and facts in a very comprehensive and thorough way. As you say, you know, if you read a newspaper article or a magazine, and there's some claim made about what someone wrote or what someone said, you really have to rely upon the author to summarize the document that he's referencing accurately and depict the parts that are relevant and to do so in a way that's faithful to the document. Because online writing allows you to link to the documents that you're talking about, enables the reader to click over and read it for him or herself, you really don't have to rely on the writer that way. The reader is able to go and see the primary sources for themselves, and I think that creates a lot more honesty in how you write, because you know that if you talk about a document or what someone else said, the person that you're writing to is going to be able to go over and check your work and see whether or not that's true. And the last aspect that I think is, you know, an important distinguishing feature is that it's much more interactive, writing online is. One of the problems with standard journalism for a long time has been that it was a one-way form of communication. You know, reporters and pundits would write a column and they would get no feedback, or they would go on TV and they would propound ideas and nobody could talk back. It was a one-way form of communication. You would just absorb what it was that they were saying, but you had no mechanism for interacting with it. And online writing is exactly the opposite. You know, you have a comment section where you immediately get feedback from all kinds of smart and engaged people. Errors that you make are immediately corrected. They have a very short lifespan. And other bloggers who are linking to what you write will respond and point out the flaws in your reasoning. And so it's a much more interactive format that I also think keeps people much more honest and expands the scope of knowledge and information that you can tap when you're writing about things, and it just makes you a much better commentator, I think.
Glenn Greenwald, some people argue that the internet and blogosphere has been especially valuable to progressives and people on the political left or at the liberal end of the political spectrum for any number of reasons, but that they've been able to take advantage of this and develop this far more than conservatives or people on political right. And this has been an instrumental part in recent electoral success by liberals compared to how they'd fared against conservatives for the past two or three decades. Do you buy that theory?
I think that theory can be overstated to some degree, but I think there's an essential truth to it. And I think that for this reason, you know, we were just talking about the kind of format-based distinctions between bloggers and journalists. What's interesting is that those format distinctions have really eroded, because even the most mainstream newspapers and magazines all now have online activity. In fact, that's the primary focus of their activity. And most reporters and opinion writers, even for the New York Times and Time Magazine and the most establishment venues, are all now writing online and even writing blogs online. But there's still a distinction, I think, between bloggers and establishment journalists that goes beyond just the format, which is the mentality or the mindset. And what I think is often overlooked is that the reason why the blogosphere arose, especially the liberal blogosphere, the progressive blogosphere arose, is because during 1998, during the Lewinsky scandal, when the media was obsessed with a petty and inconsequential sex scandal, and then into 2000 with the recount, when the media was by and large insisting that Al Gore concede in the name of moving on without figuring out who actually won, and then especially in the run-up into the Iraq War, 2002, early 2003, there was a real sense among progressives, I think quite accurately, that the media not only was failing to include progressive voices in any meaningful way, but far more importantly, that the media itself was failing in its most important function, which was serving as an adversarial check on political power. And it was really, the blogosphere really grew out of this kind of frustration with the established media that they were simply failing to give voice to what huge numbers of citizens believed. And it was really the blogosphere that enabled all of those citizens who felt similarly disenfranchised, who previously had no mechanism for collaborating with one another or for joining together, to come together in this common way and amplify their voices collectively. And now it's to the point where the largest blogs have readerships that are equal to mid-sized newspapers, and everyone in the opinion business and in journalism reads blogs, and the impact has been quite substantial. And I think you're right that a major reason why blogs have affected our political process isn't so much because it enables money to be raised or organizing to happen. It's really because it has affected the narrative, the ideas, the arguments, the perspectives that enter the media discussion. And I think that more than anything is where the influence of the blogosphere resides.
I'm Bob McChesney. This is Media Matters. You're listening to WILL AM 580. Our guest today, Glenn Greenwald, the blogger, the political writer who writes for Salon.com, author of three books, How Would a Patriot Act, A Tragic Legacy, and most recently, Great American Hypocrites. Glenn Greenwald is also the winner of the inaugural Izzy Award, given by the Park Center for Independent Media up at Ithaca College. And Glenn Greenwald will be there at Ithaca with Amy Greenwald, Amy Goodman, who will be getting it with Glenn Greenwald this week, the first award. And Glenn, I know that in the process of getting this award, you know quite a bit about I.F. Stone, who the Izzy is named after. And I think that as I was one of the judges, we were struck with the similarity of your work to I.F. Stone's and sort of his approach to journalism. Talk a little bit about I.F. Stone and what sort of journalist he was.
Well, actually, it's really interesting because I think it was probably a year or so ago when a commenter of mine, and I was just referencing earlier how that interactive feature between one's readers and one's and a blogger can really expand one's scope of knowledge. It was a reader of mine who, in a comment section, linked to the full archives of the weekly newsletter that, or the I think it was the bi-weekly newsletter that bi-monthly newsletter that Izzy Stone wrote from 1957 until 1971. It has every single newsletter that he ever wrote, and I clicked over to it, and I had been fairly familiar with his work, but had never really sat down and read in such a systematic way what he had written, and I spent literally the next several weeks ingesting all of it, and what really struck me the most was that the dissatisfaction with how the media and the government interact with one another and cooperate with one another, and the way in which the media enables and amplifies government lies, and the reasons why the media does that were all very much the sort of driving central themes of his work. And you know, he was writing at a time at the height of McCarthyite hysteria, when the fear levels were being kept very high by the government over external threats, obviously quite similar to what's happened in the Bush era. And then into the Vietnam War, when the government was lying about one matter after the next in order to make the war seem more successful than it in fact was and more justifiable than it in fact was. And in fact, that's an obvious and perfect analog to what the government did and what the media did during the Iraq War. And what was so striking to me about what his work was, and I could say a lot of things about it, but sort of the principal attribute that I found so notable is that in a lot of ways he was really the very first blogger, even though he didn't have a keyboard and links and the like, because the mentality that drove his journalism was very much this viciously independent mind, that he wanted to stay completely independent and separate from the government and media influences. And by doing that, he was able to sit there and read documents and deal only with facts and expose the truth that was being concealed. And it's very inspiring to read that somebody doing that literally week after week for that many years in such a potent way.
Yeah, it's one of the striking features of Stone's work, as yours as well, Glenn Greenwald, that it did not rely on sort of having cozy relationships with people in power and sort of playing, you know, croquet with them and having their kids go to the same schools and schmoozing with them and wanting to always be on good terms with them. In fact, that was not a part of the program whatsoever. Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, no, I mean, in fact, he was very vigilant and insistent about doing exactly the opposite, about purposely not cultivating lots of sources on the condition that he socialized with the people that he was covering and going to parties and trying to be a part of the very system that he was reporting on. He purposely kept his distance from all of that, and I try and do the same, and I do think it's, you know, irreplaceably valuable and important if you're going to be adversarial to a system to keep your distance from it and not want to become a part of it.
Our guest, Glenn Greenwald, the blogger at Salon.com, the award-winning blogger now with the Izzy Award. If you want to call into WILL AM 580, the number at Media Matters is 333-9455, the toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. Glenn Greenwald writes on politics and civil liberties. He writes long pieces, short pieces, but often and frequently at Salon.com. And I urge you to go there if you are not familiar with his work or not familiar enough with his work. You will not be disappointed if you get there. And I want to talk about some of the stuff you're writing about, Glenn, not just about blogging, although I do want to get back to that later. And, you know, let's start with the issues I think that you're concerned with as a constitutional lawyer originally and that got you into blogging and writing in politics, which is the question of the Bush-Cheney administration and torture and violation of law and whether they should be prosecuted, whether the rule of law should be suspended in their case. To me, this seems like a pretty important issue. I know it is to you, yet it sort of has fallen through the cracks in the mainstream media, to put it politely. What's your take on Bush-Cheney administration and whether they've, you know, done acts that warrant prosecution?
Well, I think you begin with the premise that the lawbreaking that they engaged in is now so indisputable and so pervasive that it's really hard to overstate. You know, just look at the two principal areas where that's true. We have a law in place in this country and have had a law in place for 30 years that says, as clearly as the English language permits, that it is a felony offense punishable by up to 5 years in prison and a $10,000 fine for each offense to eavesdrop on American citizens without first obtaining a warrant from the FISA court. I mean, that's what the law says, you can go read it. It's as clear as can be. And in 2005, the president got caught doing exactly what the law says is a felony, and he went on national television, and not only didn't he deny it, he admitted that he did it, and he said he was proud that he did it, and that he would continue to do it, and he did continue to do it. And it's a felony that he got caught committing systematically for many years, and it was done in exactly the way that the law was intended to criminalize, which was eavesdropping on Americans in secret, so that no court and nobody else knows on whom you're eavesdropping or what the reasons are, and therefore nobody can be ensured that that awesome power isn't being abused. The second area of lawbreaking, and there are many, but these are just the two most serious and transparent, is the fact that it's always been a felony for the past 8 decades for American officials to either order torture or engage in torture. We know that the Bush administration at the highest levels inside the White House authorized techniques that have long been defined as torture, that we have prosecuted before as torture, that Bush administration officials themselves said constituted torture. We have a treaty called the Convention Against Torture signed by Ronald Reagan in 1988, which says that all member states, which includes the United States, shall be obligated to criminally investigate and prosecute any government officials who authorized torture. These are simply laws in place. And so the only way that you can decide that you're going to refrain from criminally investigating and prosecuting Bush officials is if you believe that the law simply doesn't apply to our highest government officials, that they're exempt from the law, that they reside above and beyond it. And, you know, I agree with the founders that there's no more dangerous idea than exempting politically powerful people from the rule of law. And so anyone who agrees with that would have to favor enforcing the law, which means prosecuting the highest officials who deliberately broke those laws.
Barack Obama, the president of the United States, also a constitutional lawyer and taught constitutional law at the University of Chicago Law School. Why is he taking a different route, to put it politely? Why is he not interested, apparently, in prosecuting these transgressions, these crimes?
Well, I think there's a couple reasons. The first is that it has become a fairly unchallenged consensus among our political elites that the law doesn't apply to political leaders. And, you know, you go back to Richard Nixon and Gerald Ford's pardon of Richard Nixon. You'd be hard pressed to find any significant political elites during that time or now who argued that that was the wrong thing to do. And in fact, even when Gerald Ford died, there was that issue revisited, and everyone said in prominent journalistic circles, most everybody, that that was the right thing to do because it's more important that we move on as a country, that we have harmony, than it is that we enforce the law against political leaders. And then you go into the Iran-Contra scandal, and all of those lawbreakers, those felons, were either pardoned or weren't prosecuted. And our political class cheered that on, agreed with it. You had people like Richard Cohen at the Washington Post, a supposedly liberal columnist, saying that he knows Cap Weinberger from the Watergate Safeway, and he knows he's a great guy, and so it's fine with him if he got pardoned, even though he committed felonies. And so we have this ethos in our political class that the law applies to ordinary Americans. You know, we imprison more Americans than any country in the world. Our prison rate is astronomical as compared to any other Western country. We have 5% of the world's population and almost 25% of the prisoners worldwide are in the United States. We love to enforce the law and imprison people and enforce the law harshly when it comes to ordinary Americans, but the political class believes that our political leaders should be exempt from the rule of law, that things like prosecutions and courtrooms and jails aren't for them, even when they break our most serious laws. And so I think Obama is afraid of running afoul of the consensus in the political class if he decides that he's going to prosecute. And I think the other aspect of it is, it was an interesting article in the New York Times about a month ago from Charlie Savage, who basically said that there's, in essence, a gentleman's agreement among the presidents, past and current, at all times, that current presidents don't investigate past presidents, and in exchange, they know that whatever they do in office won't be criminally prosecuted by their predecessor. It's no president wants to break that agreement because they benefit greatly from it.
Sort of like a double knot spy, as Jethro Clampett used to put it, or Jethro Bodine.
Right, exactly.
Our guest, Glenn Greenwald from Salon.com, the columnist, the award-winning blogger here on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Our phone lines are open at 333-9455, toll-free 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to the phone lines now. Let's start at line two. Champaign County, you're on the air with Glenn Greenwald.
Good afternoon. Should I say greetings to Rio? I don't know if you're still hanging your hat there.
I am here, so I'll accept greetings on behalf of Rio de Janeiro.
We're vicariously enjoying it then, I guess, because it's been wretched here, actually. But I really like your radio feature. I actually haven't been back to your website. I hope you're still pulling those people together that you do audio on at Salon Radio. I wanted to ask you about not a lot has been made over here of the British. Shall I call it resolve to investigate after all their troops are out of Iraq sometime in July? We've seen, and I think you wrote a very biting criticism of the Brits for caving in to the threat. And I can't remember if this was the beginning of the Obama administration or the very end of the Bush administration, where they were strong-armed basically to not go ahead and reveal something that their own court had ordered released. So between some comments on either or both of those, this is a little bit of a digression, I guess, but you had a piece about Jeffrey Goldberg recently, and I can't remember if you went all the way back to when he was writing for The New Yorker claiming there was a tie between Iraq and al-Qaeda. He's an incredible piece of work. And I don't know if you want to spend a moment reprising that article or commenting on him and how thoroughgoing the media was. I mean, even the New Yorker, which hosts Cy Hirsch, was involved. I think Cheney was waving a copy of it around, if I recall, in the lead up to the war in Iraq. So I'll hang up and listen. Really appreciate your work. Thank you.
Thank you, caller. Glenn Greenwald?
Yeah, I'll just briefly on that last point first. You know, one of the most interesting aspects, and I think most revealing aspects about how our established media works is that you look at people like Jeffrey Goldberg, who, you know, before the Iraq War was one of the most deceitful propagandists in the country. I mean, he was writing piece after piece linking al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein and using worse and less reliable sources, even than Judy Miller. And yet not only did he remain at The New Yorker, he was hired away by The Atlantic, which lavished him with all sorts of gifts. And when they finally were close to being able to hire him away from The New Yorker, the owner of The New Yorker actually sent horses, ponies, to his children in order to sort of entice him as that final step. And it worked, and he went and joined The Atlantic. There is no accountability in our journalistic class. And if anything, the more erroneous you are on behalf of the establishment, the more rewarded you become. And Jeffrey Goldberg certainly a great example of that, although Bill Kristol, and there's lots of others as well. You know, on the issue of Britain and other countries, it is interesting, actually. There are now proceedings underway in Britain. We just released a British detainee, Benjamin Mohammed, from Guantanamo, who went back to Britain and is now talking about the fact that he was not only severely tortured for several years while in American custody, but that the British government seemed complicit in it. And like most countries that actually still believe in the rule of law and say they do, the British government feels it has no choice but to proceed to investigate criminally those allegations, because if that's true, it's against the law. And then just this week, yesterday actually, a court in Spain, a prosecutor who supervised the prosecution, the war crimes prosecution of Augusto Pinochet, issued a complaint against six Bush administration lawyers for essentially legalizing what is plainly illegal, which is the torture regime. And so you see in other countries now criminal investigations beginning that very well may implicate our own government officials, and yet we continue not only to refuse to investigate, but in the form of various actions by the Obama administration, continue to try and keep it concealed and shielded. And I think it's a pretty powerful commentary on where we are vis-a-vis even other Western European countries that went along with us, like England, when it comes to pretending at least to believe in the rule of law.
Glenn Greenwald, just wondering, you've been speaking critically of the Obama administration and how it's handled the rule of law, how it's handled the crimes of the Bush administration. What about the Obama administration's handling of the financial crisis, the economic crisis, the policies they've pursued, the bailouts of AIG and other large financial institutions? Have you been surprised or disappointed by what the Obama administration has done since taking office?
Well, I try not to have expectations of what Obama is likely to do, and I try and judge him strictly on his conduct. That said, I do think it's a little bit surprising just the extent of his willingness to rely on the very people who caused the crisis in the first place now to try and solve it. I mean, if you look at who his economic team is led by, you know, beginning with Tim Geithner and Larry Summers, you know, what you see are people who are proteges of Robert Rubin, the former Treasury Secretary under the Clinton administration, former Goldman Sachs chairman, and who was at Citibank the last 7 years at the center of this push to use these derivative instruments that were incredibly risky and reckless. And you have Geithner, of course, who was in the room with no one except Hank Paulson, a former Goldman Sachs CEO, the current Goldman Sachs CEO, when the bailout of AIG was designed back in October, which then ended up redounding greatly to the benefit of Goldman Sachs. And so, you know, Obama is obviously aware of just how incestuous is the relationship between Wall Street and Washington. I mean, he repeatedly made that the centerpiece of his campaign and pointing out that there's nothing more corrupting than that relationship, and had continuously vowed to undermine it. And yet the first thing that he does when he gets into office knowing that there's this immense financial crisis, it's going to take radical reforms of Wall Street if the crisis is going to be truly averted, is empowers the very people who are most controlled by the very Wall Street forces that caused the crisis. And so when you look at what has been proposed and what has been done in order to address this crisis, it's hardly surprising. It's almost inevitable that the biggest beneficiaries of it are the insiders in Wall Street who enriched themselves over the last 10 years by essentially destroying the world economy. And so I do think it's a little striking, just the severity and transparency of it all.
It seems that there's a hope on the part of the Obama administration that they can sort of dodge the bullet and get a recovery back and avoid a deep crisis and sort of get back to business as usual in fairly short term. And with the stock market increasing last week substantially, there was starting to see in the news media coverage along these lines that maybe they've dodged the bullet, we've seen the worst, and we're on our way to recovery. And reading your blog and the people you're citing, I don't get the sense you think that we're about to go back to happy days.
Well, you know, I think one of the absolutely dumbest storylines in the past several months is the idea that how Wall Street reacts to what the president does is an indication of how likely it is to solve the financial crisis. And the principal criticism, for example, of Geithner's banking rescue plan was that it basically constitutes an enormous subsidy to Wall Street, that it's a huge transfer of wealth from the taxpayer to the bankers in New York, and that, in fact, what it does, and this is clearly what it does, is it enables those hedge funds and bankers to reap enormous profits if the price of these distressed assets increases. But if they don't increase or if they continue to decline, the loss will be borne by the taxpayer. I mean, it's exactly what has been happening over the past decade, which is gains are privatized, and then losses are socialized, and that's exactly what this banking plan was. And so, of course, Wall Street loves this banking plan. I mean, it's basically free money, huge amounts of free money and free opportunity transferred to them at the taxpayer's expense. Of course, Wall Street is going to react favorably to it. That's not a sign that the banking plan will get us out of the crisis. It's a sign, I think, that the very people who have caused the crisis are the ones who are benefiting. And what strikes me the most is, you know, I wrote about this last week, is if you look, for example, at former officials with the International Monetary Fund, there's Simon Johnson, and there was an economist who wrote an op-ed in the Wall Street, in the Washington Post. What they're saying is quite scary, or at least it ought to be, which is that if you look at the emerging countries, the emerging markets that collapse and then were trying to recover, Russia and Argentina being the principal examples, what you see there is exactly what you now have here, which is an oligarchical system of extremely rich people who destroy the economic stability of the country through all kinds of reckless maneuvers. The government steps in, and the first things they do are try to save the oligarchical class. They try and implement programs that are designed to prop up the oligarchy and to save them from financial ruin, through huge transfers of wealth to them, through laws that will benefit them, through all kinds of measures designed to protect their wealth, which is exactly what the United States did in response to this financial crisis. And then the second thing they do is try and impose all the sacrifice on the ordinary citizens. And you see all sorts of journalists now and government officials now talking about the need for massive cuts in Medicaid and Medicare and Social Security. And that's always what ends up causing social unrest, is when the citizenry starts to see that they are being forced to pay for the super rich who caused the problem in the first place. And it's really followed the pattern exactly of Russia and Argentina and Latin American countries and some of the Asian countries that have had economic collapse. And the people who are saying that are IMF officials who studied those collapses and were involved in their rescue and are hardly, you know, raving socialists. And so I think you can see the path that we're on quite clearly if you look.
Our guest, Glenn Greenwald. I'm Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters on WILL AM 580. Glenn Greenwald is the award-winning blogger at Salon.com, author of three books, most recently Great American Hypocrites, and winner of the first Izzy Award from the Park Center for Independent Media at Ithaca College. He'll be receiving that award this coming week, along with Amy Goodman, the other winner. And I should announce that Amy Goodman will be the guest on Media Matters 2 weeks from today. So be sure to join us for that. And 1 week from today, we'll have Katrina Vanden Heuvel of the Nation magazine as our guest as well. The phone line here at Media Matters, 333-9455, the toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Let's go back to the phone lines right now. Line 2, Urbana, you're on the air with Glenn Greenwald. Hello, Urbana. I guess line 2, Urbana, is not with us any longer. So, Glenn, I think we'll go back to the show with us. You know, one of the interesting things, Glenn, has been the response of the political right and the Republican Party to the economic crisis. And it's been ridiculed by liberals and Democrats, but it's sort of, you know, it's meant that the debate has sort of taken place with Obama being sort of the left and whatever the Republicans are doing being the opposition. Can you make sense of the Republican Party at this point?
Well, you know, it's funny. I think the Republican Party has become en masse. I mean, but, you know, it's easy to ridicule Republicans right now, and journalists love to do that and are doing it. But that's because they're out of power and they're downtrodden and they look like rejected losers. And that's clearly what they are. And journalists love to revere whoever is politically ascendant and stomp on and ridicule whoever is losing politically. And so it's easy to do that now with Republicans, and they look completely bereft of ideas and like this extremist rump party filled with just all kinds of popular stupidity and radicalism and extremism. Now, the reality is they aren't any different than the Republicans who ruled the country since 2000 and even before that, you know, when Newt Gingrich was declared by our media to be America's prime minister and drove the last term of the Clinton administration. This is what they were back then, too. The only difference is that the media was highly reverent of them and treated their vapid slogans as though they were worthy of respect. And all you have to do is look around at what the United States has become, the consequences that we're now dealing with, the wreckage that the United States is buried in. And it's not hard to see why that is. It's the movement, the right-wing movement that's so easy now to laugh at and ridicule, is the same one that ruled the country almost without challenge for a decade at least. And so I'm glad that a lot of people are mocking and deriding and expressing hostility towards this right-wing movement. I think it's a decade too late.
Do I hear you correctly, Glenn Greenwald? Do you think that the argument of like the Bernie Goldbergs and people in the political right, that the news media, the Washington Press Corps, is, you know, pretty much, you know, in love with Obama and the Democrats and hostile to Republicans, do you think that is an accurate reflection of what's going on now, that the Republicans are just getting a really rough treatment by the Beltway punditocracy?
Well, I think that's a complicated question. You know, the of course, it's been a Republican cliche for, you know, the last 30 years. I mean, their main mantra that we have a left-wing media, or liberal media. And, of course, you just look at the corporations that own the largest and most influential media outlets. They're the largest corporations that benefit from Republican policies and conservative economics. And the idea that these huge corporations, are proselytizing some sort of leftist or socialist agenda is ridiculous on its face. I mean, it's just it's complete contradiction to how self-interest functions. And then you just look at tons of examples. I mean, you look at what the media did in disseminating the Bush administration's claims in the run-up to the war, the way that they sort of revered the Republican Party for the last 15 years at least. And it's easy to see that this idea that the media is some sort of left-wing conspiracy is too frivolous to even take seriously. Having said that, you know, I do think that beyond just left-right or conservative-liberal, one of the principal properties of the established media is that they revere power, as we were just talking about. They worship political success. And there is a tendency on their part to try and please whoever's in power. And the people who are in power at the moment are Democrats in Washington and then specifically the Obama White House. And so I think you do see a lot of very favorable reporting on the part of reporters who are eager to gain favor with the administration and gain access to the administration, sort of become the new Bob Woodwards, the people who are fed leaks and scoops and access. And the way that you do that is by reporting sycophantically on the president and the White House. So, you know, I think that the media is still sort of dancing to the tune of, you know, the kind of right-wing noise machine when it comes to really petty scandals. You saw that the last week with their obsession over does Obama use the teleprompter, and there was, you know, during the campaign, Reverend Wright kind of scandal. They still dance to that sort of right-wing noise machine tune on petty matters, but I think on more substantive issues, their principal instinct is to uncritically serve whoever is in power.
Is it at all disappointing to you, given the growth of the blogosphere and the emergence of the internet as an alternative in some ways to the Washington Press Corps, to watch something like the press conference of Obama last week and see, you know, the caliber of the questions, to be generous, was unimpressive. You know, so much was not mentioned. It seems if you just look at that press conference that the world that you inhabit doesn't exist yet in that circle.
Well, you know, I think, you know, it's probably always going to be that way in one sense among those people, because the people who these corporations hire are people who aren't going to talk about the issues that I write about or that others write about. You know, they're going to be sort of vapid, petty gossip mongers, and that's what they are. I mean, they are very open about the fact, for example, that they found the press conference boring because Obama talked too much about policy and was too wonkish and sort of focused on his agenda, and they talked openly about the fact that the questions were designed to create news moments, meaning questions that they would ask, not that would be designed to probe or expose, but just be designed to create dramatic moments of intrigue or drama. You know, at best they're entertainers, and at worst they're really vapid propagandists. And so I don't think it's surprising that the people who work for those networks and newspapers aren't talking about more substantive issues. What I do think is the solution is not to change them. They're never going to change. It's to expand the scope of the voices that do enter that realm. And, you know, for example, in the first press conference, you saw a blogger who was actually called on, Sam Stein of the Huffington Post, and the question that he asked was whether Obama agrees with Pat Leahy that we cannot turn the page on the Bush administration's radicalism, meaning torture and warrantless eavesdropping and the like, until we actually examine and investigate what that page was, and meaning, do you, and then ask Obama, do you support investigations of these crimes? So you can see, and I mean, the Huffington Post is hardly some radical blog. I mean, it's very much a mainstream outlet, but at least it's slightly different in its inclination. And so I think the idea is to expand the range of voices that can kind of enter that realm, either forcibly or by being allowed in. And I think that's how ideas in the debate will become diversified as well.
Glenn Greenwald, one of the problems for independent journalists working on the internet, bloggers, the blogosphere, has been the difficulty of getting the resources so people can actually make a living supporting themselves doing the sort of work you do. And I suspect you weren't able to do so initially either. It took you a while before you were able to get resource base so you could afford to do this full time from book royalties and other matters, I assume. And today I have no idea what the exact number of internet bloggers who actually make legitimate livings at it. But I suspect it's not a really huge number. Is there some way out of this? You think that there can be ways that this sector can grow with the resource base, so the blogosphere isn't going to be primarily made up of people who are volunteers or begging people for handouts, but can actually have enough people and the critical mass to really be a force, more than it is today?
Yeah, you know, that's a really good question. I mean, of course, you know, establishment media outlets themselves, and especially newspapers, are having at least as difficult of a time trying to figure out a model to sustain themselves. And you know, that's true, especially now in this economy. But even before the financial crisis, newspapers were hurting dramatically, and massive layoffs and cost cutting was the norm. And so I think there's a general search right now for a model as to how news reporting and opinion writing can sustain itself financially, not just bloggers, but the whole medium in general. Having said that, you know, I think that there are creative ways that you can sustain yourself as an independent journalist. And I think that, you know, the the ability to write online and not have to, say, have a printing press and buy supplies and the like, really the ability to just sit almost by yourself with very little help with the technology of the Internet enables a lot more of those creative solutions. I mean, the first year that I blogged full-time, I sort of used the Izzy Stone model. He refused, never sought out and didn't want any advertising of any kind for his newsletter because he didn't want to have even an appearance that he was being influenced in any way by allegiance to those advertising interests. And he was sustained almost completely, or I think completely, by the subscription fees that his readers paid in order to receive his newsletter. And essentially, that's the I used a slightly different model, but I was supported by readers as well, simply through doing a sort of once every 6 month request for donations and funds, sort of the way public radio does it, and was able to sustain myself that way. Josh Marshall at Talking Points Memo, who has really created a whole news organization of eight reporters, I think, full time, did something similar. He the very first time he wanted to go cover the Democratic primary in 2004, he asked his readers to fund it, and I think within like 12 hours, he got double the amount that he said he would need. There's a real desire on the part of people for independent, integrity-based journalism and writing, and so I think that's one way to support it. But I think you're right that one of the aspects of establishment journalism that can't be replaced by bloggers is that investigative journalism, real investigative journalism, covering wars, going to foreign capitals, really investigating what the government is doing, does take resources. And so I think the question of how independent journalists can pull those resources in order to do the kind of investigative journalism that resources require is a real question, and I don't think it's been answered adequately yet.
Our guest, Glenn Greenwald. This is Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, and WILL AM 580, coming to you live today. The phone number here, if you want to get a call in, 333-9455, toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. Glenn Greenwald, you recently been blogging about Senator Jim Webb and his work challenging the criminal justice system, or I don't know what the exact term is, prison industrial complex. And you've already talked about it a little bit on this program. It's really an extraordinary story that, again, gets almost no press coverage in the U.S. news media. And as a constitutional lawyer, I think this must be of a particular concern of yours. What's Jim Webb up to, and what are his chances?
Well, it's interesting. I think there are certain facts about the United States that are extremely significant that most people around the world recognize about the United States, but many Americans, if not most, don't. If you were to ask people around the world, what is the country that bombs and invades and occupies other countries more than any other? I mean, everybody would be able to answer immediately, the United States does that. And yet, I think if you ask most Americans that, they would have a really hard time answering that. You saw after 9/11 this confusion and bafflement of, well, when we were attacked, this sort of, why do they hate us? Why would anybody hate the United States? I think the idea that we bomb and occupy and invade and interfere in other countries far more than any others is something most Americans never appreciate. The same is true for this fact that we've become the most oppressive prison state in the world, that we imprison far more people than any others, that we put people into jail for things that no other Western country does, like nonviolent drug offenses, bouncing checks and have all kinds of harsh sentencing requirements that most of the world considers barbaric. And it's an extraordinary waste of money, and it's extremely oppressive, and it's an amazing waste of human resources. I mean, there's nothing worse you can do to somebody than to put them in a cage or to their family and take them out of society and put them in these brutal prisons. And there's a huge aspect of it that's racially discriminatory. Racial minorities are adversely affected by that more than any other, and it's a very difficult problem politically to address because most Americans believe that people are in prison because they deserve it. And with all the various social problems that need to be addressed in America among people who aren't in prison, most Americans don't have patience for the idea that they're going to elect somebody and send them to Washington, and the person is going to get to Washington and then figure out how to make life in prison less harsh and brutal for the people who are there, or figure out how to make it so that people who break the law don't have such harsh punishment. It's a very politically difficult project to work on, as imperative as it is. And here's Jim Webb, who is a first-term senator. He doesn't represent a liberal state. He's not from Massachusetts or New York or, you know, California or any of the deeply blue states. He's from Virginia, which until very recently was one of the most conservative states. It still is extremely conservative on law and order matters. It abolished parole for all prisoners in 1995. It's second only to Texas in terms of the number of citizens that it executes. And yet he's really gotten out in front and said that the American criminal justice system is a disgrace. The way in which we imprison people who shouldn't be there, the conditions that we put them in when they're inside a prison, are things that are horrifying and horrific. And he is really committed now to trying at first to create a commission to recommend changes for how these problems can be fixed and then thereafter fix them. And I, the reason why I was so struck by it is because it's just so obviously one of those very rare cases where a politician does something significant with no prospect of political gain and lots of political risk. And it's something you very rarely see. And so that's why I wrote about it.
Let's go to one final phone call now. Line two, Champagne. You're on the air with Glenn Greenwald.
Yes, my question is going to be quick, and I'm going to give you some names. But President Obama, to deflect, I think, criticism, has recently referred to cable chatter in a pejorative or slightly pejorative vein. Well, I've gotten kind of addicted to it, and I tend to agree with him. So I'm going to give you a list of people and ask you to ask if these are legitimate journalists, and if so, what's the quality of their journalism? Wolf Blitzer, CNN. Joe Scarborough, Morning Joe, MSNBC, Chris Matthews, Keith Olbermann, Rachel Maddow, Bill O'Reilly, Sean Hannity.
All right. Well, thank you very much, caller. Glenn Greenwald, you've got your batting order. Do you want to take a whack?
It's not that hard. I mean, I think cable news is just an incredible wasteland. You can actually feel your brain shrinking if you watch it. You know, it's incredibly fixated on the pettiest and most inconsequential of matters. I've been on a few of those shows before. I mean, I think Rachel Maddow is actually the smartest by far of the people who were named. I think she would like to do real journalism and actually does do some adversarial interviews that are pretty substantive. I think the problem is that the format of those cable news shows is such that you can talk about an issue for about 4 minutes. The ability to talk about an issue for 4 minutes means that you're basically not going to do much other than kind of speak within the standard consensus of already understood ideas. You can't really challenge in any fundamental way opinions in that length of time and in that format. And so I think one's ability to actually challenge ideas in a meaningful way, no matter how smart you are, no matter how committed you are, is extremely limited.
What about Keith Olbermann?
You know, I personally don't really find Keith Olbermann to be a particularly inspiring example of journalism. I kind of see him as, a left-wing kind of blowhard. I think he's an entertainer. He provided an important service in that he was one of the very few people on television making real critiques of the Bush administration over the last few years. And so I think he deserves some credit for that. But I wouldn't say that he's a journalist in any way. Any meaningful way.
Who, we only have a few seconds left, Glenn Greenwald. Who are the journalists out there that were working today that you look to that you think are doing the good stuff?
Well, I think there are some actually journalists. There are a few journalists at even some mainstream publications. The reason we know that the CIA maintained a network of black sites, gulags throughout Eastern Europe, is because Dana Priest worked extremely hard to expose it. And she ignored administration demands that she keep it concealed, and she did similar good work on the conditions of Walter Reed. I think, Jane Mayer at The New Yorker has done great work exposing the torture regime, and her book, The Dark Side, is probably the sort of gold standard for detailing the facts about what the Bush administration did. I think Charlie Savage's work at the Boston Globe.
Unfortunately, Glenn Greenwald, I think I'm going to have to cut you off at those three because I hear the band tuning up in the background, which means they want to clear me out of the studio. Glenn Greenwald, thank you so much for joining us today, Media Matters.
And my pleasure. Great to be here.
All right. Good luck with the Izzy Award. And I want to thank Andrew Boyle, my producer, Kyle Kroha, for working the board. I'm Bob McChesney. Please join me in 167 hours when I will have Katrina Vandenhoevel as my guest. And 2 weeks from today, Amy Goodman. Until then, everyone, have a great week.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance, private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events, lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
In the weather forecast for Champaign-Urbana, mostly cloudy skies today with a high of 38 degrees. Tonight will be partly cloudy with a low of 31. Monday brings partly sunny skies with a high of 54 degrees. Monday night cloudy with a chance of rain and a low of 42. And Tuesday there's a chance...